Welcome into the Podium Game Podcast. I'm Brian Gibberman, and on this episode, what we're going to do is we're going to take a look at the two different major restricted free agent situations still going on. We're going to catch up with Vince Goodwell from the Detroit News coming up in a little bit, but first, we have Paul Coral from azcentral.com, who covers the Phoenix Suns, talk about Eric Bledsoe and what's going on there. Paul, how are you doing today?
Good, Gibby. Thanks for having me on.
No, thank you for taking time out. Always appreciate it. So let's start here. What is the latest that you've been hearing on the negotiations with Bledsoe and the Suns?
The latest is, unfortunately, that they haven't really been negotiating, that there haven't been these extensive talks. Robert Sarver told me about a week ago that they hadn't even heard from Bledsoe since the end of the season. That doesn't mean they haven't heard from his camp. Of course, the agent and the GM have occasional contact. It's Rich Paul's agent, and Mark Termini, a well-known NBA agent, is the negotiator under Rich Paul. So they all still have talks, but it doesn't seem like it seemed like from what the Suns have said that they would love the chance to sit down with them and really talk. Because all we have is that four-year, $48 million offer, and that goes back to the start of free agency, that first week of July. And the reason there hasn't been anything else is because there really hasn't been any liberty to move off of that. You know, the chasm between a maximum desire and their offer is pretty huge unless you sit down and talk.
You bring up within that answer, you talked about how Sarver's talked to you. He's also talked to other people in the Phoenix media. While McDonough and Babby publicly have pretty much declined to want to talk about what's going on in the negotiations between them and Bledsoe. I mean, you specifically asked Babby about it at a press conference when they introduced Tolliver and Isaiah Thomas, and he avoided the question. How has Bledsoe's camp taken to Sarver talking about these negotiations publicly on multiple occasions?
Well, it's hard to know for sure because they're a little bit different in that they don't really talk much to the media. I've had brief conversations on next to nothing to be quoted. And, you can tell from overall media that there's probably only a couple people that camp is really being open with, and that's not even on the record. But the gist of what we get is that they've been displeased about how fervent the Suns were about keeping Bledsoe ever since the season. And I think there's a feeling that the Suns' desire to keep him and the expression that they would plan to match offers or use every right they have in restricted free agents perhaps discouraged other teams or hurt his overall value. Although if you talk to other teams, nobody really feels that way at all. And in fact, there's people who even are surprised that the Suns made such a large offer at all when they didn't have to. And obviously there was a motivation, too, there for the Suns. They didn't know nobody else was going to sign them to an offer sheet, so they were trying to strike first with what they thought was a fair deal.
Well, why do you think he hasn't garnered much interest? I mean, we saw guys like Parsons and Hayward, and obviously they're different positions, get big-time offer sheets when they were restricted free agents, and Bledsoe's a better player than them. Why hasn't the interest been there?
Yeah, and you can certainly see how Bledsoe's camp feels when those guys are getting maximum offers. And like you said, you can very well say that Bledsoe's a better player than either one of those. But Utah was in the same position where they were saying they would match to keep Hayward, and they did. I think with those guys, I think position and experience and health all come into play here. For position, there's a lot more versatility in the way you can use Hayward or Parsons on your roster than Bledsoe. If you get a wing, even with Parsons, I think teams would even use him as a stretch four at times. There's different things you can do with him. And with Bledsoe as a point guard, I think one thing that a lot of people underestimate is how many good point guards are in the league. And it doesn't leave many teams who would see Bledsoe as an upgrade or worth the investment for the slight improvement And, you know, there's, I think I counted 12 all-star point guards in the league right now. And then, you know, there's so many more that have players who they would consider their franchise point guard or a point guard on the rise. Like Philadelphia ended up being the only team with cap space, and they have a rookie of the year at point guard. So I think, you know, unless you have a two-point guard system like the Suns, I think that also hurt him, that he's not such a rare commodity anymore. And the health, and we haven't got around to the health. Of course, he's only played a half season as a starter and has two knee surgeries. And when, you know, the athleticism is one of his best attributes, that's a concern for other teams.
There was a report on Tuesday from a local media outlet in Phoenix that the Suns are now open and willing to deal Eric Bledsoe in a sign and trade. Is that a new development, or is that just kind of in their stance all along?
I think it would be a new emphasis, and it makes sense because we are now closer to the start of training camp than we were the start of free agency. So we're in the second half of this deal with Bledsoe, and it certainly probably changes their perspective about things. Their priority all along and plan was to have Eric Bledsoe on the team. They didn't go out and trade for him a year ago just to have him as a rental and give up Jared Dudley and make that deal. Their plan, and you know, Hornacek created a system for Bledsoe and Dragic to coexist. So it wasn't just an asset. It was a player that they saw as a cornerstone. If that's getting to the point where it's, you know, irretrievable, they have always been open to the idea of a sign and trade, but for value. You know, they're not just going to dump him. They, you know, at worst, they get Eric Bledsoe on a bargain $3.7 million qualifying offer this coming season, still could trade him during the season, and still would have bird rights on him next summer to pay more and have more years if they could work things out.
To your point you just made, I'd even argue a lot of people talked about how signing Isaiah Thomas was a sign that maybe they're moving on from Bledsoe. I actually thought it was the opposite. I thought signing Thomas was a sign that they believed Bledsoe was going to be here, because Bledsoe's game complements Thomas more than Dragic's game complements Thomas. That it kind of seemed like they were bringing someone else in to help Bledsoe be more successful with what he does well.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think one of the biggest weaknesses of the team last year, as much as he improved, was when they had to start Ish-Smith or play Ish-Smith heavy minutes, because, you know, he wasn't the threat as a shooter, and, you know, he was relatively he had never had that sort of heavy of a role, I guess, in his career on that important of a team. So in a system where they're at their best by having a balanced offense with two playmakers that can never let a defense overload, it's better to have two of those three guys on the court at all times. I think those three guys were all in the top 11 for point guard efficiency last year. And if you can have two of those guys on the court at all times, that's tough for other teams to plan for.
Within the report that I mentioned, the question before, the one I just asked, the person also hinted at that maybe if it was Ryan McDonough was fully in charge, this Bledsoe deal would have gotten done right after they traded them. Are they all on? Are Babby, Sarver, and McDonough all on the same page with how they want to go about handling Bledsoe?
That's an interesting question. I've never sensed any division in the ranks. You know, roles have been pretty clearly defined since McDonough came on board, and you know, Babby's best trait is as a negotiator. You know, going back to his days as a lawyer and into when he represented players, so that was a big reason why he was brought in. I don't think he's ever had to deal with something like this, particularly on the basketball side of things. And I don't think those guys do anything without talking amongst each other. Robert Sarver, in his 10 years, has been a hands-on owner. You know, he is involved in meetings. He drops in. He's got an office at the arena when he needs to be. He likes to, you know, have meetings after games and talk to those guys at all hours. It's his business just as much as his bank. And felt more and more knowledgeable about how that side of things is run. So I don't think there would be any disconnect among those three at the time. Now, if Ryan McDonough was running it solo, would it be different? Maybe they wouldn't have drawn such a hard line. Maybe he's personal value for Bledsoe is higher, and he would have pushed for a higher offer. But when no other team has made any offer sheet to him, there's really no reason for them to move off it unless they fear losing him altogether.
You brought this up in the article you wrote, I think it was on August 11th. You brought up a bunch of the different options that the two sides had. Do you think both would be amendable to meeting somewhere in the middle?
I don't think it would be in the middle. I think it would have to be more towards the Suns. I can't see the Suns moving that far when they're competing against themselves. You know, they've made mistakes in the past competing against themselves when they didn't have to. Michael Beasley, case in point, when they signed and made him an offer when no other team was even in the market for him yet. I think they would move off it, though. What were you off thinking?
So I was going to say something like 4 years between 50 and 55.
Yeah, I mean, I think that would definitely be a conversation that the Suns would be more interested in entertaining than Bledsoe's camp right now. And that's just me surmising off the feel off of both sides. I just think that, ever since the extension talks of last year, I think there's been this idea on the Bledsoe camp that he could be a max player. And I think it's been, emboldened over the season, and so it's hard to backtrack off that now for them. It's almost like a loss for them if they go backward. But, you know, really that's sort of silly when you look at he's been on a rookie contract for the last 4 years, and he would be taking a big risk to play for 3.7 in the coming year because of health or down year and everything. And then even, you know, a year from now, if he was to get a max deal, he still doesn't get into the type of money the Suns are offering until 4 years from now. It takes that long for him to recoup it, and by then he could be 28 years old and getting another prime contract on a higher CBA.
Do you think there's been, especially in our market, for the people that more columnists do opinions on radio and all that stuff, there's been a very negative tone towards Bledsoe's camp. Do you think it's fair, the negative publicity they've taken, or are they just doing their job to try and do what's best for their client?
I'm sure they think it's what's best for them. I think a lot of people who have covered the league for a while wonder if it is, and maybe there's better explanation for it than what we know, because they are played so close to the vest. They definitely are different in that regard, because you know we've known lots of agents over the year who try to go off the record and plead the case for their clients, and they really haven't done that. So maybe there's something to it that we all don't hear. Has it been a little bit unfair? I don't know. You know, we don't hear from Eric Bledsoe. The one time we did was in that TV interview in Birmingham, one question, one brief answer, and he seemed to still, even though he said that they were using free agency against him, the rules, he still said, "I understand," twice. And so as much as he turned this all over to other people and never spoken about his contract and the whole time he was in Phoenix, I think he does get it overall. And I know he likes his teammates, and I know he liked the coaches and playing, even though he could have done himself a lot more favor about expressing that outwardly. And I think he was coached maybe not to. And if he had, it certainly would have put more pressure on the organization to respond if there was a public outcry to sign him.
Which there isn't. It's actually gone the opposite way. Most
right.
of the fans I interact with are more angry at Bledsoe than they are at the Suns front office.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that stems from how he never really embraced them back. You know, he played hard, he played well. He sat out long periods with injuries. Of course, the knee surgery was needed, and it's I guess ironic in a way that health problem that might have kept him from getting another offer sheet also lowered his qualifying offer, because he was one start away from meeting the starter criteria that would have bumped the qualifying offer up another million or so. And, you know, it still would have been a low number for him, but, I want to say maybe, I think it was maybe closer to a million and a half higher. I can't remember it off the top of my head, but I think it was like 5.2 rather than 3.7. So, you know, just one little start, you know, you think back to the shin bruise that he had that kept him out for a while at the beginning of the season and coming back, you know, and his knee rehabbed carefully and everything, and that ended up costing, just one start cost him another $1.5 million maybe.
So at the end of the day, do you still expect him to be back in a Phoenix uniform and once everything plays out?
I'm certainly not as adamant about that as I used to be or confident about that. I always felt like one way or the other he would probably be back. I give a little bit of pause to that. I just don't think that they'll find the value out there in a sign and trade, even if they wanted to do it, to pull the trigger. I think it would be very hard at this point to come up with something that would satisfy the Suns, especially when they would still have options throughout the season. And he would have a no trade clause, but you know, he's obviously in a position where that's not something that he would hold ardently to if he's got his eyes elsewhere already. The problem is a year from now, you run the risk of Dragic and Bledsoe walking with nothing in return. And that's the stinger in all this.
No, that's where when people say Bledsoe has no leverage in this situation, number one, they lose him. They're not as good of a team. Number two, he signs a qualifying offer and then he's gone next year, but he can block any trade with the qualifying offer. Then you lose him for nothing. So, yeah, from a money perspective, he doesn't have leverage to ask for more, but there is some leverage there because the Suns need him to be the team that they think they can be.
Yeah, and this is a, you know, this is a critical situation for both sides. This is, you know, this is Rich Paul kind of defining himself as an agent beyond LeBron James and to do what's best for his client and show other players in the NBA about it, you know, because he just had Kevin Serafin also go to the qualifying offer. But on the flip side, it's a crucial time for the Suns because here they are having not made the playoffs since 2010. They finally got some good momentum going where people feel good about the direction and now expect them to be a playoff team. And if they don't have Eric Bledsoe, I don't think there's going to be many people who consider them a playoff team going into the season.
No, and there seems to be a feeling that they could just plug in Isaiah Thomas and Gerald Green and everything can just kind of go like it did last year. And I don't think that's true because if you look at the team, yes, Thomas is an upgrade to Ish Smith and they'll be better offensively. But if you look at what they did defensively when Bledsoe was out and Green took his place in the starting lineup, they weren't nearly as good. And that's why they went about 500 instead of winning two out of every three when Bledsoe was healthy. So if they're going to lose him, they got it. They have to get some sort of defensive presence with an offensive skill set that complements Dragic also to be able to keep this thing rolling.
Yeah. Well, yeah, those are polar opposites defensively, Gerald Green and Eric Bledsoe. That's about as different as you can get. As great as Gerald was to get hot offensively, he's not in there for defensive reasons. And I just think Bledsoe, even with Bledsoe back, I don't think you can assume the Suns are a playoff team. There's no automatic natural progression into them being a postseason team. You've got guys, first off, they lost Channing Frye, you know, and I know how you feel. You agree with me that he's just, you know, a huge part of what they did and it has ripple effects in a lot of areas. But also now you've got guys who aren't, you know, who now expect minutes, who expect a certain amount of shots. You know, the chemistry was so wonderful last year. Is it going to stay that perfect still? You're working in new people, rookies. You know, T.J. Warren's got to get minutes. Who's that going to affect? And all these things start coming into play, and teams like New Orleans, Denver, that didn't make the playoffs last year, they're having the same conversations in their cities that they expect to get into the playoffs too. And who's coming out?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I mean, the West is loaded, and as you said, with Fry, I would have said if they would have brought Fry back, if they would have brought the same team back and added Isaiah Thomas, I would have been pretty confident if they would have made the playoffs. Now, even if they bring Bledsoe back and you're moving Markieff to the starting power forward, you're just losing something that they had last year. And they're going to have to adjust. Their offensive scheme in some way is going to have to be adjusted for the spacing they're losing with Fry, because I don't think Tolliver, while he's a good piece, I don't know if he can do it as consistently as Fry has done it over time.
No, you know, I think Tolliver's a player who worked hard and has improved and everything, but he's not replacing Channing Frye. He's replacing some of his minutes off the bench. Markieff Morris has to step up. Tolliver, you know, he played three mostly last year. He's played four in the past, but, you know, not considered to be a great defensive player or rebounder. Had his best career year three-point shooting last year, but he also had Al Jefferson on the block to draw people down, and the Suns don't have that type of post presence to give them that kind of space.
All right, Paul, you have anything that you'd like to plug or get out there?
Boy, I wish I could say, you know, I'm working on a piece. Can't tell you the drop date, but we're doing a package about the 10-year anniversaries of the ownership changes of the Suns and Diamondbacks. So that should be coming up in the next couple of weeks, but I'm not sure what date that'll be.
All right, so keep an eye out for that at acentral.com. You can also follow Paul on Twitter at Paul Coro. Very simple. Paul, thank you very much for checking in. Appreciate it.
All right, always good to talk to you. Thanks for having me.
Now we head to the Midwest to discuss the Greg Monroe situation. Vince Goodwill from the Detroit News. He covers the Pistons. Vince, how you doing today?
Doing well. How about you, Brian?
I'm doing very well. All right, so the last time you wrote about the Monroe situation was August 11th. Has anything changed since then? And if not, just give the people who are listening a synopsis of where we stand.
No, nothing has changed from that moment. Essentially what I wrote was that I'd received word that there was a very strong indication given from Greg Monroe's camp that he would be willing to take the qualifying offer of $5.4 million and not necessarily because he was dissatisfied with the Pistons' long-term offer. Everything to that point had been, the tenor to that point, I would say, had been that Monroe wasn't getting what he wanted in restricted free agency by way of receiving an offer sheet. And I never believed that that was his stated intention or even unstated intention to begin with. You take the qualifying offer because you want, either you don't want, you don't like the situation you're in, or you don't like the money. And I don't believe that Greg Monroe's first choice necessarily was to return to Detroit in a long-term situation. So taking the qualifying offer, Brian, this is a long story short, taking the qualifying offer would give him the flexibility and the freedom of going through this next summer without having to worry about a restricted free agency or the Pistons matching a particular offer.
So essentially, he didn't want to risk signing an offer sheet with another team and having the Pistons match it, which is the only which is why he explored signing trades, but didn't look for offers for a signing sheet.
Yeah, I never believed that Greg Monroe was going out looking for an offer sheet, because you only go out looking for an offer sheet if you honestly believe that your team, the team that holds your rights, won't pay you unless someone else will. And money, I think a lot of people would like to believe that money is always the motivating factor, but Davis Falk, his agent, who has said publicly and privately that he was never worried about the money market for Greg Monroe, and usually agents say that type of thing or whatever, and you can look at the Evan Turner deal as evidence that sometimes it can go the other way. But I don't think that Falk or Monroe's thing was just, okay, well, we'll just get the max from whoever, and the Pistons will match the offer, and we'll be there for another 4 years. I don't think that that was the leverage play that they were going to use. I think the leverage play that they were going to use was, let's see if we can get him out of town and into a better situation, into a more winning situation, as opposed to being in Detroit where he'll be on his, you know, fifth coach in 5 years and new front office and, you know, all those other type of variables that are in place.
The quotes that I've read from Van Gundy, it makes it seem like he would like to have Monroe back. Was he not able to sell? Was it more Monroe wasn't buying what Van Gundy was selling for the future, or just he doesn't want to be involved with the current construct of the team, and he doesn't, he has worries about them not being able to move a piece to allow him to play, allow him to be successful.
Well, I think this could be a mixture of all of those things, Brian. I never get the indication from anybody around Greg or even Greg himself that he had anything against Stan Van Gundy. You know, from day one, Stan Van Gundy knew that Greg Monroe was, you know, his free agency, the situation was priority number one. And, you know, you guys got to think, you know, 9 times out of 10, a guy signs his rookie deal, he's locked in for 4 years. So pretty much no matter what happens, he's going to be locked into that situation. You know, whether it's coaching, whether it's, you know, the supporting cast, you know, you really don't have a say of what's going on, and this is the first chance of leverage that you get. So when he's going through all the turnover and all the changes, and then still there's been no realistic success in Detroit for his first 4 years, he has serious doubts about locking himself into a 4-year deal or a 5-year deal to where he won't have any leverage. He can't necessarily force his way out as easily once he signs a 4-year deal or 5-year deal or whatever, as he does now if things don't necessarily work out. So I do think that although he likes Stan Van Gundy, the evidence of what's happened over the past 4 years is of greater concern to him than what the possibility of the future is.
If he signed the qualifying offer, had the Pistons overachieved this year, they ended up being a pretty solid team, do you think he would be open to returning to Detroit?
Yeah, I do. I think that Stan Van Gundy is he's not in an impossible situation with a qualifying offer. He's just in a show me and show me quickly type of situation. I think people naturally assume that, you know, no matter what happens, that Greg Monroe will want out of Detroit. And although right now the likelihood is that, you know, the Pistons won't necessarily be a playoff team, with the way the Eastern Conference looks, with how much better the East is or how much more balanced the Eastern Conference is. If they surprise, if possibly, you know, they trade Josh Smith through the season and can balance out the floor and balance out the roster a little bit, I don't think Greg Monroe was ever that unhappy in Detroit as far as, you know, just hating everything about it, that he would turn his back on an optimistic part of the future. Now, if it's still same old Pistons as it's been for the past 4 years or so, then it's not going to make a decision hard for him to leave. And even then, it's not even going to make a decision hard for the Pistons if midway through the season they're out of the playoff contention. They might try to trade him just so they can get something back for him. And even then, because of the qualifying offer, you know, Monroe has to approve of any trade anywhere that he goes. So, you know, there still leaves a little bit of a gray area there too.
Van Gundy truly want to re-sign him, or does he just not want to lose an asset for nothing?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think in part it's because you don't know what you really have in Andre Drummond. You know, he is the stated centerpiece and future of this team, but Andre does not have the develop or the polish on his game yet that you can truly build around definitively. You know, who knows what he'll develop into in the next 2 or 3 years, but as of right now, Greg Monroe is your most consistent player. He's your most important player from a standpoint of, you know, getting you buckets on the low post and consistent production, even if you don't necessarily like, you know, necessarily how he does it. The fact of the matter remains is that it's 16-10. And you don't want 16-10 to walk out of the door for nothing, even if you have an Andre Drummond next to him. Now, on the flip side of that, you know, if Drummond develops this year, if he develops and turns into a Dwight Howard type of player when Dwight was 21 or whatever the case may be, then that makes it a little easier to swallow, and that gives you a little bit more of a clear vision of what you'll need to build around him. And you can stomach losing a Greg Monroe, you know, if you're getting the right pieces in return. But as of right now, Stan Van Gundy can't be in the business of just losing assets for nothing. And I think he's made that very clear from day one.
Now, Monroe is an interesting player with how the league's going and what his game is. Does Van Gundy see him as a center or someone that needs to play with a rim protector next to him?
Well, I think he has to play with a rim protector next to him. And I don't think that because you play center, that means that you can't play with a rim protector. Let's just take the New Orleans Hornets or Pelicans. I'm sorry, forgive me. Let's just take the New Orleans Pelicans. If you put them next to
Anthony, screwing that up left and right, also don't think that.
trust me, it's not rolling off the tip of my tongue like it should. But take the New Orleans franchise, shall we say? If you pair him next to Anthony Davis, Anthony Davis isn't big enough, wide enough to play the five on a night-to-night basis. So Greg Monroe could play the five against smaller, or I don't say smaller guys, but guys who aren't as quick, more plotters. And Anthony Davis could still be your rim protector, your help side defender, even playing four, and even with him maybe chasing around the stretch fours and guys like that, he could still do enough work around the basket to provide defense. Now, if you slide him, Greg Monroe, next to Andre Drummond, Drummond's not going to be out 20 feet from the basket playing against those stretch fours, and we already saw from this past season that it's a tough task for Greg Monroe to do. So I think he's a natural center who can possibly play power forward in the right situation. Right now in Detroit, it's not the ideal situation, even with him and Drummond by themselves in a traditional setup. But then you add Josh Smith to the situation, then it's just one big cluster of, you know, size but no real plan there, or at least no real rim protection in the way of consistency, because although Drummond is developing there, he wasn't very good last year, in my estimation, protecting the rim on a consistent basis. So it exacerbates the problem when you have a Monroe playing the four who already has defensive liabilities already, and then the bigs that you have alongside of him and Smith and Drummond were having their struggles as well.
And that's kind of the conundrum with Monroe. It takes, yes, he's a very skilled player and does some things really well, but you almost need such a uniquely gifted player to play next to him that it makes him kind of hard to build around.
Well, the one thing about Van Gundy is he's made good team defenders out of bad individual defenders. You know, you've taken a guy like J.J. Redick, and he's taken that, you know, Orlando Magic team, and he sort of molded his style around those guys. And even if you aren't necessarily quick of foot or your reaction time isn't as quick, if you understand concepts and spacing in today's game, you might be able to get by, provided that you have backside help. Now, Greg Monroe struggled last year defensively. Everybody struggled last year. Was that because of coaching, or was that because of personnel, or was that because of fit? Nobody really knows. So until Stan Van Gundy actually sees his, you know, lineups in application, he can't accurately judge if Greg Monroe is a legitimate piece for the future, or if he's just a piece that will help get you by, and then all of a sudden you can just trade him for more athleticism on the wings, or a better point guard, or whatever it is that they might need to build alongside Andre Drummond, assuming that Andre Drummond turns out to be the real deal.
Now, they prefer Monroe to Smith, and it's basically they haven't been able to find a way to move Smith. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Yeah, I mean, just add to the fact that Josh Smith has 3 years and $40 million left on his contract, and his athleticism is not going to improve. He's still an athletic player for his position, but as we saw last year, he had trouble chasing around small forwards. So that's not going to be a position that he plays in abundance this year. And after the fact that Greg Monroe's a restricted free agent, you know, if you're trying to win quickly and you're trying to balance that situation out, obviously moving Greg Monroe, despite his age, despite his youth, despite, you know, all the good qualities, it would behoove you, if you want to win quicker, to maybe move him for more better-fitting pieces, as opposed to maybe bringing Josh Smith off the bench or trying to move Josh Smith and taking trash back in return, which is clear that Stan Van Gundy doesn't want to do. He does not want to take back another team's trash just to get rid of a guy he perceives to be a useful player in Josh.
So if all three of these guys end up on the team next year, it's also fair to assume that those Drummond, Monroe, Smith lineups won't be played with the same abundance as last year.
Oh, I would certainly bet, and I'm not a bettor, but I would certainly bet that there would be very, very few times that you would see all three guys on the floor together. There was an instance last year where Josh Smith was suspended for missing a team flight back from Atlanta, and he wound up coming off the bench. And I tweeted it out before the game. I said, you know what, maybe this is Josh Smith's best ideal role, where if you have to play him with these two guys, that he comes off the bench, he's the utility guy, he can play a little bit of three, he can play a mostly four, and you work your way around that without having those three guys on the floor together. Now, you know, I got laughed off of Twitter for that, but, you know, now it's looking like that if those three guys return, that's the possibility of a Caron Butler starting at three or a Kyle Singler starting at three, at least in some form. Maybe you start off the year with all three starting together and then just using your substitution patterns to compensate for that, maybe doing quick subs, very, very quick subs early in games. But then what's the chance that you develop continuity? So I think Stan Van Gundy has the task in front of him, assuming that Greg Monroe returns, that you have to sort of balance out all three guys without changing up the chemistry with, you know, although you can argue that there wasn't a lot of chemistry there last year to begin with anyway, but there is definitely the challenge of trying to develop continuity if you're starting all three guys. And I don't think that there should be a scenario where all three guys should start.
Do you think you can build a team that can compete on a regular basis to make Eastern Conference Finals, second round of the playoffs, with a player, with what Monroe is a player?
I think it's less about what Monroe is and more about what's around him. You know, so many times we peg guys into, you know, is he a superstar, is he not, and all sort of type of thing. But if Greg Monroe is maybe your third option offensively, but he's your most consistent ball player, maybe even your second option, but with a really strong third option, I don't see why you couldn't, because there's no substitution for consistency. You know, he may not be one of the best finishers at the rim, but that's where he takes the majority of his shots, and a lot of times just getting there is half the battle, where some guys won't even put themselves on the block, and we've seen guys who drift further and further out to the perimeter. Greg Monroe knows where his money is made. And with better spacing, with better personnel around him, with a point guard who knows where to give him the ball and develops chemistry with him, yet why can't he be that type of guy even if he's physically limited? You know, I do think that there's sort of this trend of going smaller and everything else, but I don't think there's a substitute, you know, for getting easy baskets at the front of the rim.
Do you think his mid-range jumper is something that can get more consistent with time?
I think it's just been proven. I do think it's been proven that it may take a little time, and I think people naturally came to this conclusion, well, he's known for a full year that Drummond was going to play center, so that jumper should develop. That all makes sense in theory, but it takes a lot of time to adjust from being a 10 feet and in player to turn into this 15-foot ball player who's your first inclination is to get close to the basket, and now you're being told or you're being expected to take, you know, jump shots. He has a very long form that takes a lot of time to get up. He doesn't jump very high. So you wonder about other guys blocking your shots to help defense coming around you, you know, even from a perimeter. So can he improve his jump shot? Yes, but I don't think it'll be as rapid as people expect it to be. You know, to bring up a guy like Karl Malone, you know, he was in the league 10 years before he really became a consistent 15-foot-and-out shooter. And this is a guy who we've pegged as possibly one of the two or three best power forwards in league history. So if it takes a long time for a guy like him to stretch his game out and become a more consistent shooter, then to expect Greg Monroe to have that type of progression that quickly, I believe, is a little bit unrealistic.
All right, here's your opportunity. You get one chance at this. Would you like to yell at Greg Monroe for ruining your offseason?
Greg, I'm sure that Greg Monroe is as astute as he is, already knows that he has supremely ruined not only my offseason, but Ben Tellis from the Detroit Free Press and David Mayo from NBA Media Group and everybody else who follows the Detroit Pistons. He knows what this stalemate has done. And on media day, provided that he's there, aside from saying, welcome back, Greg, I will tell him that he owes me a couple extra weeks of vacation time with pay.
Well, I hope you get some of that vacation time in. Vin, thank you very much. Oh, before I let you go, you got anything you want? I know it's kind of the dead season besides this. You have anything out there you want to plug or let people know about?
My Twitter feed, Be Good Will. Please keep all clownish comments off of my Twitter feed. But read me at the Detroit News at thedebtnews.com, and subscribe to this great podcast with the guys at HP. They do great work.
All right, Vince, thank you very much. All right, we heard about Bledsoe. We heard about Monroe. Got everything covered on all the restricted free agents. That wraps up this edition of the Podium Game Podcast. Vince.